Welcome to the Babylon Podcast Year in Review for 2009. I'm Summer Brooks, Tim Callender, and Jeffrey Willerth, all rolled into one convenient and easily disposed of package. Thanks for listening to us throughout the year, and of course all of the years. We really appreciate all our fans, all the input that you guys have given us over the years, and this is one way we can repay your loyalty. So let's start with the biggest event for the Babcast. No, I am not talking about the JMS interview. I'm talking about an upgrade of equipment.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
You won't believe it, but I am Tim Callender.
Holy cow! What? My ears hurt. Hey, it's Jeffrey in Los Angeles, and happy Willerth Day.
Yes.
Oh, no.
That's right. We're recording this on April 22nd, officially Willerth Day.
Yep. Yeah. And you know what that means is you get those recyclable totes that you can put over Jeffrey's head.
There you go. Save the planet. There you go.
That's right.
Wow, Tim, you sound amazing.
Well, I just came back from my sojourn in toward the galactic core, and now that I'm outside of the radiation zone from the supermassive black hole at the galaxy center, transmissions are just that much more cleaner.
Nice.
Wow.
Nice. This is great. We don't have to go back and do all the other shows again now, do we?
No, just me. We're going to do the special edition Babylon podcast. I get to go back and do all my parts again, and we're going to edit it in.
Nice. Put Brad
re-release
right
it. Yeah, exactly. Very Summer good. Gets to shoot first this time, though.
So this is thanks to your new technology in town?
Yeah, we just got Fios installed on Monday here in the Callender household.
Fios, F-I-O-S, meaning S- finally fiber. In our solar system.
Yes, and the vocal quality is so good that when we tried to have our abortive attempt at a contest to name the voices in the Year 4 Babcast Open, nobody recognized me. People thought I was Jeffrey. So it's been a good year here for us at the Babcast. We geeked deeply on the end of Season 4 and well into Season 5 of Babylon 5. The year saw more publications from the Babylon 5 Scripts team, including the Asked and Answered Epic Collection, which gathered up all the various internet postings that the great maker had made over the years. We didn't quite get to Crusade, as promised in this year's show intro, but the topic came up a few times in Feedback Paloozas. And the reason Crusade didn't slot in this year? We had a bumper crop of interviews, and we're going to go through and touch some of the highlights on some of those for you here in this show. First up is the one long-awaited interview that everybody had been clamoring for. Again, not the JMS interview, but Ed Wasser, Mr. Morden himself, appeared. Here's a few excerpts from that interview.
Hello, this is Ed.
Hey, Ed, it's Jeffrey. How are you?
Jeffrey, how you doing, buddy?
I am excellent. You sound terrific.
Well, good.
You are probably one of the most anticipated interviews that we've had lined up.
Oh, I can't believe that.
You were the most requested guest all of last year. They kept pestering us. When are you going to talk to Ed? When are you going to talk to Ed? I don't know.
Yeah.
Why don't you hang up and keep them waiting? The thing about Morden is that, you know, you didn't really have to do much except smile and say Straczynski's lines, and it was all over from then on in. It was just like Morden had its own life, and I was always so fascinated how mesmerized people were by the character. Morden was one of those characters that you just, there wasn't, it was hard to bite your teeth into him. You know, you couldn't really, he was so smooth and so slick that there wasn't really a whole lot of emotion going on. So the challenge was to really be present with the characters that I was working opposite of. You know, that was the only thing that I think that I had to hold on to. When I showed up to the set, I didn't really have, you know, I didn't really have any. Morden doesn't have any emotional range, really. I think the only time we see Morden get emotional is when Londo blows up end and says, take off his head.
I think that's what drew a lot of the fans in. You have this seemingly innocuous, handsome guy who's just evil behind the charming face. And you don't get a lot of that in sci-fi television until you. So thank you for that.
Wow. Thank you for that.
So how did you come to be Mr. Bourne in the first place?
Well, I begged, groveled, and pleaded. I stood outside with a little tin cup with dark glasses and started singing Dixie, and they just said, wow, what a great Morton he would be. Anyway, the way that happened for me was I actually started out with Mary Jo Slater and Dory Zuckerman at the time, who was one of the casting directors for Babylon 5 when they first started out doing the pilot. And Dory had said, hey, Ed, why don't you come in and be a reader? And at the time, I was kind of in my ego and said, no, I don't think so, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to go back to New York. And Dory said, well, you know, I think it'd be a good idea if you were a reader. And I'm going, well, what exactly does a reader do? So I learned the process and came in and became a reader at Dory's suggestion, and I was very grateful for that. And what happened was I got to sit around with the producers and the director and, you know, John and Joe and all those guys. And one thing led to another, and they handed me a script, and it was the pilot, and they said, okay, why don't you pick a part? Tell us what you'd like, you know, what part you'd like to do. By the way, any of the parts that have names attached to it, you don't get to pick those. So you get to pick number one, tech number two, or tech number three. So I figured tech number one would be a good place to start. So I picked tech number one. And I came to the set, and I was very techie, and that was it. And then the show got picked up, and they said, hey, Ed, would you like to come in and be a reader again? And of course, my ego popped up, and I went, oh, a reader again? How about a part? But I humbled myself, and I said, okay, thank you. I'll come in and be a reader. And I think two or three, maybe four episodes had gone by. They had done casting for, and, you know, now I'm kind of feeling like a family. And so Joe and I had it wasn't a bad relationship. It wasn't a great relationship. It was just, you know, Joe was very respectful of me, and I, of course, was trying to kiss as much ass as I could and be as useful and as needed as I could be. And one day, Joe offered me a part as a maitre d' for the Jeffrey, what was that?
The Zocalo?
Give me for not remembering. Yes. The restaurant. And so, and I looked at it and I thought, wow, you know, I'm really grateful. It was a couple of days later, I came back to Joe and said, well, I'm really grateful for the offer. It's really thoughtful. Thank you. But don't you have something for me that has a little more meat to it? Something a little more dangerous? I had no idea that he would come up with Mr. Morton. But that's how I ended up with Mr. Morton. I really enjoyed the experience of traveling and meeting the fans and going to the sci-fi conventions and just meeting all the people that made it possible to be on a show like that. You know, the fans really showed their support. That was exciting. I met some great people, you know, the president of my fan club. The fan club is such a joke to me in a way, because it really, you know, I feel like I'm they're my fans. I feel like I'm their fan. I feel grateful to them. And by the way, just for the record, I'm also a grandpa.
Whoa! Whoa! Yeah. Whoa! Yeah.
Congratulations.
Wow.
my two girls, my wife's first marriage, when I met my wife, the girls were 9 and 11, and now they're 23 and 25. And the 23-year-old, Ashley, and Eric, they had a baby girl. Her name is Dylan. And we are now grandparents of a beautiful baby girl that's 5 weeks old.
You are an amazing grandpa. You would be like the best grandpa ever. I can just tell. You are. You are.
Nice and close. And I look at him and I go, what do you want?
Yes. Grandpa Ed. I'm not sure whether I'd be pleased or frightened to ask him for what I want. We had a return visit from Stephen First. That was a very entertaining interview and difficult to pull bits and pieces out because I kind of got to rambling around and very entertaining, but I did my best, so check it out.
Was the transition from directing to producing similar to or different than the transition from acting to directing?
The director on these things, I was kind of acting like the producer too, you know. But, you know, it's all just making movies. I just love making movies. And, you know, if I'm directing it, fine. That's a lot of work, though. And if I'm producing it, I love finding material good and that nobody else has, you know, if you option a John Grisham novel, that's different. You know it's going to be somewhat good, you know, or Stephen King. But I love finding these little gems that are undiscovered and try to solve them.
Yeah. You've done that for quite a long time. So Tim is dying to ask you a few questions. I wonder if you even remember anything about Deconstruction of Falling Stars.
I do. Which episode was that, though? What did it have to do with?
Then you don't remember.
Well, I mean, if you tell me which one it is, I can remember.
No, it's the episode where we look at the history of the Babylon 5 universe from a million years in the future. And
I did that one.
Deconstruction of Falling Stars with the framework of basically looking back at the characters across a million years. What challenges did that present in terms of telling a different kind of story, do you think? From a director's standpoint, you're reading the script and you realize and it's rather different than what that has been done on the show prior.
Well, you know what? You're absolutely right. I don't remember. And that was too cerebral of a question for me.
So let me ask you this question. From the standpoint of being an actor as part of an ensemble like you were on Babylon 5, and now you're behind the camera as a director, does the dynamic and the relationship with the other cast members change?
You know, I just think during Babylon 5 or anything I direct?
Well, specifically Babylon 5.
You know, during Babylon 5, they were just, I think, went above and beyond being supportive of me because I was one of them. And on other things like Sci-Fi Channel movies, I think actors don't question me as much as they probably would another director because, you know, I've been there as an actor and they trust that I know what I'm talking about.
I gotta ask you this because as I was just going through some of these notes here to try and refresh my memory of what we did back then and what that show was all about, that episode. I recall now that the end credits included a little statement that said, dedicated to all the people who predicted that the Babylon Project would fail in its mission, faith manages. Was that something that was discussed with you, or did that just show up in post?
Where was this? Oh, at the end of the episode?
Yes, in the credit line, in the credits.
I can't remember, to tell you the truth, Jeffrey, whether it was discussed with me. Well, not in the script.
I don't know that it was in the
script. Yeah, I don't remember. To be honest with you, I don't remember. I should have said, you know what? It was not, and I wrote that. But I'm just too honest. I'm like the only honest guy in Hollywood, so. Actually, it was my idea, Babylon 5, anyway. I'm just being honest with you.
Yeah, that's right. I get it.
And, you know, JMS, you know, a guy I met, you know, a while ago, he did, she wrote that I did. He wrote it. And I said, why not give this guy another shot? You know, it was my idea for the Changeling as well.
Yes, I understand. Right. Very good.
He actually wanted to cast Drew Barrymore, and I said, no, go with Angelina Jolie.
Because she has huge tracts of land.
It's true.
Is it true that you are the official keeper of the photos where everyone's flipping the bird to the camera?
Well, I had that photo, but I think Rick Biggs had the same photo, you know?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
People love that photo. It's they awesome. Really do. It's a big seller.
Yeah, it is. It's a shame because I think I was the guy that actually went and had the prints made. I think we only made like 14 of them or something like that.
Well, that's what I tell the fans. I said, this is only one of 14. And as soon as they buy it, you know, I just pull out another stack.
Smart. Very smart. Very smart.
See, I number them myself. You know, I do like a litho print number.
The end of the year saw a surprise guest show up, thanks to our friends over at Slice of Sci-Fi. Okay, Summer's on Slice of Sci-Fi too, so, you know, it's that kind of incestuous connection in the Farpoint Media family. But we managed to, completely surprise to us, land an interview with Brad Dourif, who of course played Brother Edward in the excellent episode Passing Through Gethsemane.
But off air, Brad, you said that you remember a lot of this. You know,
I do remember it. I was saying that one of the first times that I suddenly realized I was getting older was on that set. I had to like run down the hall and trip and lose. I guess I was carrying a bag or something, and I had to lose the bag. So I had to do it several times, and I suddenly realized, you know what? You're getting too old for this. You're not bouncing the way you used to. Hurting more than it used to hurt.
Brad, tell us, how did you land the role of Brother Edward, and was the process of getting on Babylon 5 any different from getting on any other show you'd been involved in?
Gosh, I wish I had a story there. They offered it to me, and I accepted it. That was really the beginning, end, and middle of the whole decision to do it. I liked Babylon 5 a lot. I mean, I thought that series was unique in a lot of respects. It was really like a novel in the way that it was, there's a lot more shows that are like that now where they're really continuous stories, but that was cool. I mean, I didn't always like science fiction. I mean, I always liked science fiction, but I didn't always watch it. For years I didn't miss a Babylon 5.
What did you take away from what that story was telling?
From Gethsemane?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I guess you know what? I don't know what that story was really about. Mm-hmm. The idea of Gethsemane is, do I have the courage to really make a painful sacrifice? Am I Christ-like? I mean, this is the ultimate thing that Christ allowed himself to be crucified for the good of mankind. Well, that's an extraordinary sacrifice. And I guess we all have to make sacrifices in order to, and our ability to do that and how well we do that determines the effect we have on other people and how happy we are. I guess I darn if I didn't just discover what it meant.
We continued to hear stories behind the camera, beneath the scenes, under the shower curtain. Russ Johnson tells us what it was like to leave his DNA behind for Jeffrey.
Yeah, no, I was working at Optic Nerve as, it was one of those kind of weird deals where I just started, I started working for them. They were doing a number of pictures down at Corman Films, an interesting experience in and of itself. And I was just hired to be a runner for a week. And at the end of the week, you know, the boss said, well, we may have a little work, you know, come back in on Monday. And then, you know, at the end of the next week, it was like, well, we've got a little more work, come back in on Monday. So that basically went on for like 2 years. And it was sort of like in the Princess Bride, when it's like, you've done a fine job, it's wonderful, now I shall probably kill you. And, you know, then you continue to work. And in the course of that, they got the series Babylon 5. And so I kind of got upgraded from general all-around grunt to production coordinator and on-set puppeteer creature guy. And it was kind of a Cinderella story because, as I said, the suit had already been created for the TV movie and showed up in a crate. And, of course, you know, as soon as we got it, you know, we ripped it open. And, you know, you got a shop full of nerds all very excited about their work. And we pulled the suit out and everybody's trying it on and running around in it and, you know, wearing it like a dress. And then everybody, like, tried to put on the helmet. And literally, I was the only one with a head small enough for it to fit. So that is how I was cast in the part. It was not my fine miming skills or anything beyond that. It's just the suit fit.
That's so great. Now, was that or was that not the single most uncomfortable piece of garb you have ever put on your body?
Well, you know, the from the neck down, it's very free flowing. It's actually quite comfortable. You can be wearing, you know, anything or nothing, but
yeah,
the helmet.
That's how you lost the gig, right? Because you were commando all the time.
And as it turns out, you know, some of the female extras were not cool with that.
After the lawsuit was settled, then what happened?
After all the restraining orders were dealt with, then I was able to work again in the, you know, in the United States. Everything below the neck was fine. The helmet was, even though, I mean, I managed to fit it, it was a little tight. And the one thing that was, you know, always, I think I still have a small little dot in my forehead where the gear, the little cervix that would work the iris would dig right into my temple. Yeah. And like certain, you know, depending on who was puppeteering it, some people like turning that thing off and on like every 5 seconds. Like it was open, yes. Shut, open, shut, open, shut. And so it was like digging right into my forehead. Yeah. That part was less than fun.
Yeah. Yeah. The servo that he's talking about would open and close the iris on the front, and it would make a little noise. You could hear it inside the helmet. And it would... And you could tell if you had somebody who really knew, the puppeteer that really knew what they were doing. Hey, no, wait, let me say, they all knew what they were doing. It's just some were a little more zealous and trying to, you know, they were creating a Rambo character and others were creating this insight mysterious Vorlon, you know. So some people would be like, you know, and then others ones would be like, you know, xylophone or like scratching at the disco.
Yeah. And those are the ones that would draw blood. What Optic Nerve had decided and the production had decided was to... pulled, positives off the old suit. They made a new fiberglass shoulder encasing, made a new helmet, all as like a stunt thing that they built with a hinge on the back that had a little lever that would then, you know, lift perfectly up and then, you know, stick a 2K in the bottom and the light would go out and it was going to be this whole thing. They repainted it, all very elaborate.
Yes.
And it was so, you know, it was so crushed in terms of the schedule. It was like literally they were just finishing it the day it was supposed to shoot. and I mean, stop me if you've heard. Stop me if you've heard this. So I went to go pick it up to bring it back to the set to do the shoot. And literally the paint was drying and we were going to put it in the flatbed of my truck. And so I started laying it down and the guy who was the shop foreman at the time was like, no, that'll smudge the paint. Don't do that. Just have it up, have it standing up. I was like, I don't know. That doesn't seem like a very good idea. Like, no, you've got to do that. Here, we'll just take this PA. We'll put him in the back of your truck. He'll hold on to it. It'll be fine. Okay. So we are driving down the 5, a large, you know, 4-lane highway on the way to the set. And all of a sudden I hear this squeal. I mean, like a giant squirrel in the flatbed. And I turn around, this kid has turned pale white. He's literally squealing as the fiberglass top and the head peels off of the body and goes flying into the middle of the highway. And I mean, it's all happening in slow motion, and I'm just seeing, you know, my job, you know, my life as I know it, you know, being destroyed. But the thing that's amazing is it was just so well made, it didn't blow up on the highway. I mean, it was still there, sitting in the middle of the highway. So I pulled off to the side of the road and literally was prepared to. I, like, walked out into one lane, and I was going to go get it. I was convinced I could get it, and we can save it, and it was going to be okay. And I swear to God, this guy in a huge, like, bright red Dodge Ram swerved not to avoid it, but to hit it. And literally moved into the lane, hit it, and the whole thing just disappeared in a cloud of fiberglass. That was it. It was gone. Probably the first time somebody showed me a picture of myself after they, like, take the helmet off and standing there covered in sweat and stank and the whole thing, you know, I have to admit, I tried to be diligent about it because it was my own, you know, business, but it's not like they alcoholed that thing down on a regular basis. So it was kind of one of the guys on the show lovingly referred to it as the fart bong. So you can imagine that it was not always the most, like, you know, fragrant place on the set.
Yeah. Were you actually rehearsing dialogue and speaking dialogue with the other cast when you were in the suit?
I did, you know, just to the extent, obviously, that it could be timed with the other actors. I mean, it was very difficult to hear someone talking with that helmet on. But, you know, I have to say that one of the things that was great about it is, you know, most of the actors, and especially the other actors who were performing in prosthetics, or, you know, Peter and Mira and Andreas, I mean, were always great about trying to, you know, encourage you or be like, you know, oh, that's, you know, I appreciate what you were giving me, you know, in the scene, and, you know, and like making you a part of the performance. Although, as I always say, it's like, look, I can only move my head in 6 directions. So it's not like I'm giving you some Brando thing here. It's like, should I move my head back or to the left? Maybe I'll go right this time. It was not what you'd call Stella Adler material. And yet they were always very gracious about, you know, trying to include you as one of the cast.
Now, did you give Jeffrey any hint of what he was in for by wearing that suit? Or did you just say, thumbs up, buddy, it's going to be the time of your life?
I think he got a hint the second he put that helmet on, like you said, and got that dose of DNA and, like, you know, 1 year's worth of stank. I don't think words can describe it. I mean, I think it was all said in an aroma for what he was in for. And he still seemed game, so, you know, and obviously, he, you know, did well.
We talked with Troy Rutter, who established Babylon 5's presence on the internet.
Why don't you introduce yourself to everyone who might not be familiar with just how long you've been involved with the Babylon 5 universe?
Sure.
And all of the stuff you've done.
All right. Well, my name is Troy Rutter, and for those who may not know, I was also known as another name, B5 Online, on America Online. And basically, I was in charge of doing the updating and producing the Babylon 5 website at Babylon5.com and also AOL keyword Babylon 5. The history of Babylon 5 being promoted by Warner Brothers is actually really interesting in that, you know, now you see shows on the internet all the time and you don't realize that it was groundbreaking. Not only Joe doing this, but the Warner Brothers in general. And what they did was they released the Babylon 5 training cards, the infamous interactive press kit. I'm sure some of you have seen some of that. It was in a little a black paper sleeve, and it had 2 3.5 discs in it, and you had to swap discs.
I never saw that one.
Yeah,
oh, really?
I never saw that either.
Oh, yes. It's still around somewhere, and you push little buttons, and it made little sounds and stuff. And there's one where you hit something, and it's just Londo and Jakar screaming at each other for like 2 seconds, and that's the whole clip. Of course, it's at about 120 by 90 pixels, you know, because it's so small.
Right.
Back then. And those were produced by Hollywood Online. And then eventually, and it sounds very strange now, but Babylon 5 was first promoted online by Warner Brothers on the Extra website. And, you know, things were really great. Here I was working on my favorite show, and Some of it was difficult at times because I never knew if I was included whenever Joe would talk about the suits, if that included me or not. But we went through a lot of good things that happened during that time, and eventually we got the AOL site, keyword AOL, which was huge. No other TV show besides Extra and Rosie O'Donnell had their own AOL sites. Two completely different spectrums there. We had Rosie on one side and Babylon 5 on the other. But eventually we, as you can imagine happened with a growing division and the internet booming, I got pulled onto other projects. I got pulled onto Rosie O'Donnell. I got Jenny Jones, Queen Latifah. And I couldn't say no. You know, it was where I wanted to be. And eventually it got to where I really wasn't doing much Babylon 5 anymore. And at that point I left, and that is pretty much why the website wasn't updated for about a year.
I guess the question is, you know, how much give and take was there?
It was mostly me for the most part. They left me alone. Some of the best times I had were going over to the Warner Brothers archive department and going through the slide books and trying to pull slides. Say, oh, this one's neat. This one's neat. You know, give me a copy of this one, this one, this one, this one, and take them back, scan them, slap the little URL on the bottom, and put them up. But then you also had things that were actually programmed by our programming department, and those could get a little dicey. Tell you about one of those cross promotions happened in November. I don't remember which year it was, but we actually went to the Babylon 5 studios and sat down with Joe, John Copeland, Jeffrey, George Johnson, who's a riot, by the way. I wish I could find him again. I haven't talked to him in years. My boss, my boss's boss, and the head of Warner Brothers Online. And we sat down in this room with Joe, and she started out, this is our director, and she said, well, we like to program things in advance. And we have this Valentine's Day promotion coming up in February. This was in November. And she says, I'm looking through the characters on the show. Is it too late to tie something in with the show? And Joe was like, well, what did you have in mind? He's like, well, could Ivanova get a Valentine's from someone and not know who it's from? And could we work that into the show? And of course, the answer is no, absolutely not. You know, right. She's like, well, what about Christmas? Do they celebrate Christmas on Babylon 5? And Joe kind of pauses a moment, and he looks to John and looks to me, and my head is in my hands at this point, you know, and I'm like, oh, geez, I'm so embarrassed. And Joe goes, you know, maybe we could do something. And the words that came out of Joe's mouth were, how about a very drowsy Christmas? And our director was like, yeah, can we do that? And he just kind of looked around. He's like, no. So I took this very drowsy Christmas thing and I went back to the office and remember this time we're dealing with Photoshop like 2 or Photoshop 3. And yeah, I put together a very drowsy Christmas album with drowsy on the front with a Christmas hat and a scarf and sent it over to the stage. And I didn't hear much for a while. And then a couple weeks later, I went over there and there plastered on every soundstage was this blown up picture of a very drowsy Christmas. So I guess it went over really well. So we used to do those online chats, which are reminiscent of you know, what we're doing now, except then I had to type for everybody.
Right.
So
yes.
You were the one manning the keyboard.
I was the one typing and hosting for both of them. Yes. So I would have two computers. I would host on one and screen questions on one and then hop to the other one. And whether they were at our office or on the phone, I would be typing for them and go back to the other one, ask another question, go back to the other computer. And so I've never taken a typing test, but it's probably a 120 plus words per minute. So, you know, I still try to do things today. I still, I have two websites. I have Babylon5props.com, which I tried to keep track of all the props that were on eBay a few years ago. And those pictures, I think Sandra has some more on her site. And I also have Babylon5fans.com, where I actually do have all those old sounds and graphics and QuickTime VRs and things on there. And I try to keep those up because, you know, it's part of the history of Babylon 5. And as Joe has shown, you know, with everything being documented, that history is important and it can be used. And I had no idea the Asked and Answers volumes were coming out until I saw them. But, you know, I was like, well, maybe some of the stuff that I contributed were used in there. And that's pretty cool.
We also talked to people who are keeping the spirit of Babylon 5 alive today. First up was author Frank Garcia, who with Mark Phillips wrote a textbook called Science Fiction Television Series 1990 to 2004, in which Babylon 5 has a prime entry.
Your article was that it was a model for future shows. Is that what?
Correct.
Right. So now looking back a decade later, did the model actually play out?
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
I think the answer is yes, because I can see the influences and the pushing of the boundaries in a show like Battlestar Galactica. I think one of the main ways that it influenced today's television is serialization. We see it in Lost. We see it in Heroes. Television is now more accepting of serialized storytelling. In the days when they wouldn't do it, when it was more standalone storytelling. I think today's television is also more accepting of a large ensemble cast. I think today's television is more demanding on a visual level. We have far better tools today on visual effects. And Babylon 5 obviously pioneered computer-generated visual effects on space shows and even on shows that are not space shows. And I think strong vision by series creators is also something else that we're seeing a lot, notably with people like Carlson Cuse and Damon Lindelof in Lost. So I think there's a number of ways in which we can see that influence today. Well, you'll remember me as a researcher with the Sci-Fi Channel show, Sciography.
Oh, my gosh, yes, absolutely. And yes, I do. There you go. Sciography was a great show, right?
You worked on the Sciography for Babylon 5?
Well, Sciography only lasted 2 episodes. they broadcasted Sciography was a short-lived Sci-Fi Channel series devoted to documentaries of our favorite science fiction shows, and they only broadcasted 2 shows, one on Battlestar Galactica, the original show, and Quantum Leap. But as a matter of fact, yes, they did do a Babylon 5 episode. And after the first book is published, Mark Phillips and I were hired as researchers for Sciography. And we worked on that show, helping them get to know the science fiction shows that they were planning to create. And in fact, there is, they filmed a Babylon 5 documentary. So hidden somewhere in the vaults of Sci-Fi Channel is a B5 documentary nobody's ever seen. Mm. Which is very unfortunate because I very much have liked to have seen that.
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah. So have I.
We interviewed Gary Hassan, who his company, Lightspeed, provides high-quality artwork to science fiction fandom and B5 fans specifically as well. Also provides actors and other talent for science fiction conventions.
And we're back. I have a very special guest. Now, I wasn't lying. This is truly one of the great humans on the planet, one of the nicest people, the purest heart, the greatest level of integrity, and he's adorable besides all that. I want you to meet Gary Hassan of Lightspeed Fine Arts. Gary, this is Tim, Summer, and Michael. Welcome to the Babylon Podcast.
Well, Michael, compliments will get you everywhere. Thank you.
And this is truly some of the finest, coolest, bestest ever sci-fi art that's ever been done. Everything has a very realistic touch to it. And why is that, Gary?
Well, we wanted to make all the artwork as realistic as possible so that, you know, the fans could see, you know, their favorite actors or their favorite scenes from their, you know, their favorite TV series or the movies. And be able to put it on their wall and kind of still, you know, relive and relive the memory of that particular show that they loved.
I mean,
so we have to make sure we have the best art.
You do. And you obviously have a bunch of talented artists that work for you and with you. That it's almost three-dimensional. I mean, the artwork jumps off the canvas. I mean, it's not like just 2D. It's a very, very interactive look for being a two-dimensional object.
Well, we're very fortunate to have the top guns working for us. I mean, these guys are Emmy Award winners, Academy Award nominees. These guys are the best. We have, you know, one of our artists Keith Birdsong is one of the few living artists that's in the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. for his artwork. So, you know, we use the best guys, the guys that actually do the art on the shows. And, you know, they're just brilliant, creative guys. And then we come up with the ideas that, you know, in our team at Lightspeed, and when we choose which artist we think is going to be the best at, you know, making it, you know, make it really realistic. And a lot of the guys that, you know, do our art actually do the artwork on the shows.
As I'm looking at your website here, I'm seeing Stargate, Star Trek, Enterprise, Star Wars, Farscape, Lord of the Rings, Xena, Hercules, 2001. It goes on and on and on. And then there's this little show at the bottom called Babylon 5.
At the bottom? I thought that was at the top. It could be at the top. I don't know who did that.
You're going to have to say something to somebody.
Well, you know, Babylon 5 has always been one of our core, you know, properties that we've loved to work with, and we were very fortunate that Joe Straczynski allowed us to do the artwork for the show, for the at least for the fans, and he was very, you know, selective on who he had do work and what kind of products that he allowed for the show. So we were very fortunate that he allowed us to and he chose us to do that kind of work, and I love that Babylon 5 art that we created, and as you know, you're one of the characters in the show, and you're actually in one of the prints. So we've had great success with those. And even at today's show, even though Babylon 5 has been off the air, we have our fans buying those products still today, and they love them. You know, Lightspeed also brings actors to shows, and we represent people like Bill Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, Kate Mulgrew, Avery. But we also work with our Babylon 5 characters and the like. And I brought Bruce Boxleitner and Tracy Scoggins to Dragon Con. And, hey, And actually, you know who else was there? Was Peter Jurassic and Stephen Furst and Claudia Christian. And we all got together, as a matter of fact, for dinner on Saturday night, and it was wonderful.
What inspires the scenes from the shows that you do? Because my favorite B5 one actually isn't the cast photo. It's the photo with the shadow battle around B5 in space. There's just something very, very captivating about that one scene for me. It's just beautiful.
Well, it's full of life and action.
We love that episode. That was called War Without End. And that was the name of that particular show which depicts that scene. And you didn't see that particular scene actually in the show, but we saw the battle, and so we basically created an image of what this battle would look like if you had to stop it in time. And it was a favorite of a lot of the fans, and so that's why we did that particular piece. We do a lot of our pieces with the idea of we're all fan kids in the office. So we basically say, what would be the highlight of this particular movie or this particular series or something like that?
You're one of the nicest men I've ever met, and you are just a pleasant person to be with, and I'm so grateful to call you a friend. But
Thank you. You
back that up each year with a wonderful charity event you do. I think it's coming up December 5th and 6th this year.
Yes, it's our 10th annual celebrity charity event, whose basic beneficiary is the American Cancer Society. And I've been working with them for over 20 years, using art as a way to raise money and awareness for the Cancer Society. But this event is basically something that I came up with where I could use my contacts with the actor community and have everybody kind of get together at the end of the year and do something for those less fortunate. And I don't care what charity an actor would like to contribute to, as long as they're doing something as far as a contribution at the end of the year that would benefit whatever favorite charity they have. And if they don't have a favorite charity, then the funds go to the American Cancer Society. And then we have people coming from all over the world for this event. I bring in about 25 different actors, and 12 on one day, 13 on another. And, we have a real nice lineup. And we have people coming from the UK, from Europe, from Australia, New Zealand, from Canada, United States. They even have a young lady that comes every year from the Canary Islands. And it's a great event. And we cater it, and the people love it because it's a very intimate experience with the actors, and we have the actors contribute something of their own personal, collections, or maybe it's like, for example, Patrick Stewart had a pair of running shoes favorite running shoes that he's donating, along with his hat from Moby Dick that he did with Hallmark. And he signed that. I was with him Sunday, and he signed that for me. And that's what his contribution is. Bill Shatner's always been very, very generous, getting us walk-ons on Boston Legal, and where people can actually be on the set of the show and be a part of it and have lunch and meet the actors. It's things like that that you don't get at your regular common everyday show that you go to.
We have two very special guests, and why don't you guys introduce yourselves?
I'm Jan Schroeder, and I'm a member of the Babylon 5 Scripts team.
I'm Jason Davis, and I also am a member of the Babylon 5 Scripts team.
When they first announced Lost Tales, and they said, what three stories would be in it, that's the one I was the most looking forward to. And then they cut it.
You're going to like this a lot.
I am. Excellent.
Well, if you like Garibaldi, yeah. I had that copy or that segment in the script that I had gotten back right after they had made the DVD. And it was really a shame to lose it because it was an excellent vehicle, I guess, for Jerry Doyle. It was practically a one-man episode.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. It would have been awesome to see Jerry play all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of fun. It's one of those things where you understand the reasons it wasn't done, and you just wish that there was some way that it could be, you know, retroactively inserted back into the, you know, the shooting schedule or whatever.
So what other surprises await fans when they order their copy of the movie script books?
You've got a nice collection of photos, too. One of the things that I like about how this book was set up is instead of all of the photos being in the back, we've got some that are from Legend of the Rangers, and that's in the section with Legend of the Rangers, and the same thing with Lost Tales. So we've actually got the photos matched up with the scripts.
Oh, nice.
And there are some really nice photos in there. The last photo before the Lost Tales script is my personal favorite, though. So when you see it, you'll appreciate that for the perverse sense of humor that Joe Straczynski has. I think all the changes, particularly if we're speaking about Legend of the Rangers, all the changes that are made between what's in this script book and what you saw in the television movie were made for a very specific reason. If you look at them, if you're a writer and you look at them, you know from a story point of view why these things were done. As for just in speaking about the movies in general, I mean, you have to take into consideration, I mean, Third Space, for example, was written at the end of season 4 when they weren't sure if there was going to be a season 5. River of Souls was written right after Objects at Rest. So in a lot of ways, you have to consider them the last episodes of their respective seasons, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of that going on, and he's trying to get as many ideas into these movies as possible, because in both cases of River and Souls and Third Space, both of them could have very easily been the last Babylon 5.
Some of them were more to my taste than others. I loved Legend of the Rangers, which personally I think gets a really bad rap undeservedly. Third Space is not as much to my taste because I'm not much of one for the Lovecraftian way of doing type of stories. Yeah, but I liked all of because they were very experimental, and those are the ones those are the type of episodes I always like a lot.
Yeah, what about the scripts book, the extras? What did you find when putting this together that surprised you that you never expected to see?
Oh, a fragment of an outline talking about the Telepath War movie. That was a bit of a shock. The earlier version of Rangers was one of those things that I just assumed it was going to be, you know, fairly close to what was aired. And then I started reading it, and I was like, wait a minute. And then there was just, you know, it was not what I expected to find. I didn't realize there would be so much of a change from one to the other. So that was a big shock. I really enjoyed the short story, which it was a nice thing that I had missed out on. When it was originally published in the Book of Dark Wisdom, I didn't even know it existed until Jan mentioned it to me, and I was like, what do you mean there's a short story by Joe Straczynski that I don't know about? How did this happen? I have all the Twilight Zone short stories, I have all the rest of the stuff, why am I missing this one? So, you know, that's great for people like me who missed it entirely the first time around.
No Babcast would be complete without the contribution of Gary in Jacksonville. This year, official show contributor Gary attended DragonCon, where there was a plethora, nay, a cornucopia, of Babylon 5 actors present. And Gary was gracious enough to give us a report.
It's a special mission of information, a debriefing, shall we say.
Yes.
Of a very important gathering of Babylon 5 cast and fans at this year's DragonCon.
Oh yeah, it was just it was really a lot of fun. You know, when I got, they had three different panels with several of the crew, or I guess the actors, and I left everyone, you know, grinning ear to ear. I swear I was almost floating after the first one, and it just got better and better. I really had a heck of a good time. There was other stuff that did go on at DragonCon, but the main reason I went was, of course, to, you know, see the cast from Babylon 5, and I got to meet them all, got the cheap pictures taken with them. Well, they weren't that cheap, and and had a lot of fun.
I think this was actually officially the, you know, 15th year celebration or something. Were they billing it as that, Gary?
billing it, you were lucky to find it half the time. They were moving rooms around on us last minute, so it was a little tricky to find it. I didn't see any 15th anniversary billing or anything like that, no summer. A lot of people did show up. As you said, there were three panels, and they had different levels of attendance for a few different reasons.
And who did you have to sleep with to get the first question in?
Well, I just showed my credentials as being with the Babylon podcast, and I still had to wait first in line. Yeah. I should have used your name at one point, Jeffrey, but I was so awestruck by talking to one of the cast that it just...
A real member of the cast?
Yes, actually, I was staying on the same floor with Stephen first, and at one point, we're both waiting for an elevator. And so I walk up, and he was already there, and I was like, oh! And, you know, I was just starstruck, really, and I was talking to him for a few minutes, and I said, oh, you know, thanks for coming here, those sort of, you know, niceties. And I mentioned, oh, yeah, I contribute to the Babylon podcast. And he said, the what? And I said, the Babylon podcast, you know, they're out of Arizona, and, you know, they're with Farpoint Media. Who? And I said, you've been on it a few times. And he said, really?
You should have said, yeah, the phone interviews you did with Jeffrey.
As I said, I was too starstruck to flash Jeffrey's name around. But yes, Tracy, Bruce, Claudia, Peter, and Steven were on the second panel. So, you know, there were five people there. It was moderated. Her name escapes me, but I thought she did a nice job of steering the conversation and intermixing questions and answers, that type of thing. Of course, he realized the horrible thing that, you know, Lost Tales became, and both he and Tracy talked about that, yeah, they were really on a shoestring budget. You don't quite understand how tight and rough things were shooting that whole DVD. He said they absolutely agree with Joe that he should not make another one like that. He thought that the studio was really taking advantage of him.
So you said you ran into Tracy in a hallway somewhere?
I did see her. I saw her a few times. I was chit-chatting with her, and she had her mother with her as well, and she's a very sweet woman. No doubt where Tracy got it from. And, I wasn't talking to her about anything specific. I certainly wasn't going to ask her, you know, what size corset she was wearing in
River of Souls.
In River of Souls. But I was just talking to her for a few minutes, you know, about things, about how she enjoys these, you know, conventions and things like that. And she said they're fun. She doesn't like to do a lot of them, but, you know, she enjoys, you know, getting out once in a while and, you know, letting the fans know that, you know, it's appreciated, their support. There was one guy this is a fan. He had four different Babylon 5 costumes. He had the Army of Light, and he wore a different one each day. He had an Army of Light. He had the regular blue Earth Alliance. He had a Psycor. Yeah, and what was the last? And I can't remember what his last costume was. Oh, I'm sorry, the last one wasn't Babylon 5 related. But he had that many Babylon 5 costumes because I was waiting in line when we were going to take the pictures that Tim was talking about. I was like, oh my gosh! And he came all the way. I want to say it was from Scotland. I'm not sure, and I think primarily because of the Babylon 5 people.
Despite his protestations, R. Vorlon's a pretty smart guy, and sometimes he even proves it.
But back to her, I think her opening statement was all about the light and the dark, and it is a parable by which we all live. It is a dynamic that we all, I mean, daily I wrestle with, you know, Chardonnay port. I'm stuck between the light and the dark myself.
Mix them together and get a rosé.
Oh.
Yeah. All right. Let's see what I remembered there.
Wow.
The Babylon 5 Mall Tour was a lot like the Las Vegas Star Trek Experience Light. It was, as you described, it was a small set, if you will, that was sectioned up and was allowed to be, you know, was easily traveled and went around the country on a limited tour,
my recollection was yeah, that's my recollection.
A half uneaten bag of fries from yeah, okay.
Maybe it was a dozen cities. Maybe.
I have no memory of there being a mall tour.
Yeah, yeah. It was a very cool little set that this happened between season 4 and 5. It was a huge promotion that TNT came up with to help pimp the idea that B5 was now on TNT. And you know, it was certainly, I really think it was more than 6 cities, but I don't think it went more than 12 cities. So maybe it was like 6 to 10 cities, something like that. And what we would do is we flew various members of the cast into the cities on kind of a rotating basis, and the fans could come to the mall and see the set. The set, I'm trying to remember if it was, I really draw a blank as to what the set was, though. If it was, I don't think it was trying to emulate any particular part of the ship. It wasn't like we were in the
down below. You had a
rummage through, yeah, dangerous, vile, toxic stuff. Yeah, no. But there were some. There, it was more than anything. It was more of a traveling museum because there were real props that were along on the show and or on the tour, if you will, and and there were some various set pieces that were used and a few things that were made specifically for that. For the project, and I went to it. Oh, there was also, I think there was electronic kiosk. You might have, I could be wrong about this. This is 100 years ago, but it was about that time that the B5 CD-ROM game was out, and it's possible that there was a beta version of that that was playing, because I know there was interactivity. Mm-hmm. There were some kiosk or a kiosk or a multi-station kiosk where people could sit there and play video games of some type and do trivia tests and stuff. And then, I bet you if you Google B5 Mall show or something like that, you might dig out some photos of somebody, you know, some of the stars on that tour. But it was cool. It was a lot of fun. I went to it in Atlanta. I think TNT sent me down to Atlanta and I saw it there.
You want to hear my Majel story?
Please, sure. Absolutely.
I kissed Majel. No.
No.
No, no, wait. That's not a true statement. Majel kissed me.
Aw.
Serious kiss on the lips.
Ooh.
No.
On stage in front of a bunch of fans.
Okay, do tell.
Yeah, exactly. I think, if I recall, it was a little sci-fi convention here in Burbank, LostCon, I think is what it's called. And we, a bunch of the B5 actors were there. I don't remember what season we were in, probably 3 or 4. And Majel and her production partners had developed a project with Doug Netter that I believe at the time the working title was what was the Travolta movie? Battleground Earth?
Battlefield.
Okay, so it was the opposite. I think this was called Battleground Earth at the time. Huh. And so it was looking good, and they were excited about the project at the time, and so I don't know, somehow I guess the stage, we were all the actors were on stage and we were doing our talk and all that sort of stuff, and then it was like time for Majel to come up and make this announcement about this project that she and Doug were doing, and I guess I was the last person with the microphone, so I went to hand the mic off to Majel so she could talk about it, and she just walked up and just planted one on me, and I was like, oh, my God. Majel, just, wow. It was wet, too. It was kind of cool. But I digress.
That's 401 magnets.
I guess.
Did she mistake you for someone else, or did she really miss you? I mean, did she really, really miss you?
I'm not sure. It just caught me by surprise. It's not, you know, uncommon to give that little air kiss or a little peck on the cheek as you're, you know, doing that cordial thing to make it look good in front of the fans that you're all buddy buddies. And not that I wasn't buddy buddies with Majel. In fact, you know, Gene Jr. and I are Gene Jr., you know, Rod, as he's preferred, you guys know him as, you know, Rod and I were friends for many years, and I think we still are. We just don't talk much, as is the way life goes. But so she knew who I was. Yeah, there was no doubt about that. But so late at night, sometimes I sit up in bed and just think about that.
Ah, the fact that you can only look at Gary Cole and only see Mr. Brady, you don't get out enough.
Because that's the only thing I see.
Literally, I look at Gary Cole, and I had a problem with, you know, that first time, that first episode, because I had, you know, Sheriff Buck in my head from American Gothic. And Sheriff Buck was basically, you know, a demon, a devil. He was evil, incarnate, ruling this one town. And I just
saw him walking onto the bridge of the Excalibur and saying to Lieutenant Matheson, "Yeah, I'm going to need you to come into work on Saturday.
I'm going to need those TPS reporters." Yeah, there's that too.
No, you know, speaking strictly as a fan, I think I had. I kind of share that same thought, that it was just, it was a question of casting. And sadly, it's that typecasting problem that happens. Gary Cole has had an amazing career, and has nailed all the characters he's done. And I'm not taking anything away from Crusade. But somehow you're right. You know, that his persona just didn't seem to be a, you know, the captain of a ship. Yeah, it just wasn't quite the right thing.
I would disagree with you. I think he did a great job with Gideon, in the sense that he was against type. He wasn't the swashbuckling Captain Kirk type. He wasn't the adventurous, hard on your sleeve type, like a John Sheridan. He wasn't the man of courageous convictions like a Jean-Luc Picard, and I found that kind of refreshing.
You know who he reminded me of?
Who?
Malcolm Reynolds. Just his attitude towards commanding a ship, and I don't know. I think I appreciate it because he's not commanding a military operation. He's commanding a research operation that could turn dangerous. You might have to start shooting, but it's not, even though he's in Earth Force, it's not a strict military structure like we had with Babylon 5 and the destroyer ships.
Well, it seemed like he was the outsider that never really quite fit into Earth Force, and they finally found something for him to do.
Yeah, I will agree with that.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, a promotion from the accounting department to, you know,
but still, you know. go watch some episodes of American Gothic where he is channeling pure evil, and you will never look at Gideon the same again. Especially when you start talking about that apocalypse box.
Oh yeah,
I have taken Alice and the kids to hell.
Back later.
Okay.
It does raise the good question, though: is had casting been different for the captain, would that have impacted the show?
I don't know.
And its success.
See, told you we'd make it to Crusade, even if it was argument about whether or not Gary Cole works as Captain Gideon. I think he does. Whatever. Anyways, that's pretty much it for our year in review. There's a lot out there that got left on the cutting room floor, digitally speaking, of course. And if we missed your favorite bit, No, well, you've already got the podcast. Go back, queue it up on your iPod or your MP3 player, whatever, and listen to it again. Anyways, it was fun going through all this. And again, thanks to everyone who's listened to us this year and every year prior to that. Looking forward to a great fifth year for the Babylon podcast coming up. Even though we're closing rapidly on the end of season 5, we still got the TV movies, we've got Crusade, we've got the novels to go through, so I think we might be doing this for a few more months. Anyways, as Agent 6 might say to you, be seen.